And welcome back to Open Line here at WOSU 820 and PR News. This hour on the show, we all know that exercise is good for our bodies. It can strengthen our muscles, improve our sense of balance. It can reduce blood pressure. Weight-bearing exercise can help prevent osteoporosis, but we may not be aware that there is plenty of scientific evidence to show that regular aerobic exercise can improve the functioning of our brains to help reduce the negative effects of stress, to relieve anxiety and depression, to decrease our chances of developing memory loss, and mitigate the effects of aging on the functions of our brains. We're going to learn more about the beneficial effects of exercise on our brain this hour, including such things as beating stress, sharpening our thinking, lifting our mood, and boosting our memory, and much more. My guest, Dr. John Rahe, is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His new book is entitled Spark, and it is subtitled The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. Welcome to Open Line, Dr. John Rahe. Good to have you here.
Great to be with you.
And we're at, as always, when we have a physician on the show, no individual situations or cases, but of course, general questions are very welcome at 614-292-8513. So, John, you're saying that exercise really modifies it, intensifies it, makes more active and accurate the movements and the of our brain, the various functions of our brain.
Right. Yep. In this day and age, we think of the brain as a muscle anyway, and we all know what doing exercise does to your muscles. It builds them and it stresses them at a mild level. And then the stress in the recovery period, you build the brain, you build the muscle up. And the same thing happens with the brain. And we know now we're learning more and more about it. And it does it on the short term and the long term. It certainly increases collateral circulation, which we all sort of know about because of the work done on cardiac rehab. When people have a heart attack or have angina, they're start exercising and they make more blood vessels into their heart muscle to strengthen it and give it more oxygen and food and all that. The same thing happens in the brain. But also when we exercise, even on the short term, we're elevating our neurochemicals and not just our famous neurotransmitters that communicate from one nerve cell to another, but a whole another group of factors that are called brain growth factors that I call Miracle-Gro or fertilizer for the brain. It keeps our brain cells working optimally and helps them deal with stress now and in the future and actually builds the nerve cells. It flowers them, and the sexy thing is it helps develop our stem cells in our brain into new nerve cells.
Okay, so when we participate in aerobic exercise, we are increasing the supply of certain neurochemicals is one thing we're doing. What are those chemicals, and are they beneficial?
Sure. They're dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, and GABA, amongst others. But those are the targets that psychiatrists use to target with our medications for anxiety, for depression, mm-hmm. for attention, and they do that fairly quickly and very nicely, and so that's why we see this elevation of mood and sharpening of our attention almost immediately, and then in the longer term, we have these other factors that come along to help us solidify our memories and help ourselves feel young and perky.
You know, you cite a Duke University study which concluded that exercise relieves clinical depression as effectively as Zoloft, which is a pharmaceutical in antidepressant. Tell me about that.
No, that was a tremendous study back in the 90s. The people at Duke University have sort of led the way first with the cardiac rehab in the 70s and 80s, and then began to notice that, hey, they were also seeing their cardiac patients having less depression, less anxiety. They started to write about it and then do research. This one was a very good study that came out in 99, where they took a whole group of depressed people who came in for treatment, put one group on an exercise program of four times a week, 40 minutes of gradually increasing aerobic exercise to where they were about to the level where they were sweating, and kept them at it for a period of 4 weeks. And another group they put on medicine, Zoloft, up to 200 milligrams a day. And another group they combined the two. Well, at the end of 4 weeks, all the participants had the same drop in their depressive scores. And this led to a lot of publicity that lasted all of a week or so. And then it went out of everyone's consciousness. Mm-hmm. Made the front page, made probably CNN. Another study came out just recently by the same group confirming that, only looking at the adding a placebo group and strengthening their scientific rigor for over a 3 or 4 year period of time, and a bigger number of patients, and replicated the same finding
over a 3 or 4 year period.
Yes, yes. So in other words, they just looking at people to solidify the science, because they were criticized, but they didn't have a placebo group and all this other criticisms coming. But what they showed was that exercise was as effective as Zoloft was, and they also used Zoloft in this one, over the course of time in reducing the depressive scores as compared to placebo.
And again, when we talk about the kind of exercise, it was four times a week. It was 40 minutes. It was aerobic to the point of sweating. So maybe on a treadmill or something like that.
It just says 70 or 75% of maximum heart rate, which is something that one measure that exercise physiologists use to determine, you know, the aerobic stress and strain.
So as a psychiatrist, John, when you have a patient who is depressed, then do you think of exercise as a possibility for them as much as you think of an antidepressant as a possibility?
Yeah, absolutely, and I recommend that to them. I mean, and by the way, this year the AMA incoming president back in February, I think, said, look, exercise is medicine, and every doctor, every physician, on every patient visit, no matter what the doctor is doing or whatever, should recommend exercise as a patient going out. Mm-hmm. In other words, to remind them that this is a way to help them be healthy in their body, but also in their mind and their brain, and manage their mood in a very holistic kind of way.
I have the impression, though, that many psychiatrists and many other health practitioners do not know about this, or at least don't recommend exercise, and maybe just see the person to figure, well, let's see whom you're depressed or you're anxious, which anti-anxiety medication or which depression medication should we put you on?
Absolutely. It's harder to get, it's certainly hard to get depressed people moving, but it can be done, and it is done oftentimes, and people... I have a number of cases in my book, and certainly cases reported all the time of people relieving their depression and anxiety by starting an exercise program. So that it's known, but it's hard work for people to to get there, or especially when they're feeling poorly. And it takes a little bit of effort and by their loved ones or and certainly by themselves to get to the gym or to get outside and start that brisk walking, which is the way it's done most of the time.
So you might you put somebody on, in the case of depression or in the case of anxiety, might you put somebody on a medication in order to get them to the point where they could start an exercise program?
Exactly. I mean, depression is a horrible state to have, and certainly if it's mild, it's something that people can manage, and then they might want to try the exercise alone, but certainly I'm not... And what do I call a psychopharmacologic Calvinist? That is, you don't have to always pull yourself up by the bootstraps, but if exercise can do it, then why not? Certainly use medicines as needed.
My guest, Dr. John Rahe, is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His new book is Spark. It's subtitled The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the brain. We're at 614-292-8513. Well, John, as people get older, you know, they have what they call senior moments, and they can start having them in their 40s, in which they go for somebody's name, and it's there. They know their name, but you can't get the name, or you go for a word, and you can't find the word. That's a phenomenon that your colleague Daniel Schechter calls blocking. But I don't know. Tell me whether exercise improves that situation or improves memory in general.
Well, I think lots of our studies show that exercise absolutely improves memory and the ability to recall things and keeps your cells going that are on a decline mode. That's how the whole neuroscience of exercise really got started in the 90s.
So
when there was a big study looking at Alzheimer and its prevention, and the three factors that they discovered, and one of them was exercise.
As a preventative for Alzheimer's.
Preventative. And they couldn't understand that. It was not sort of something that was intuitively obvious, other than its health benefits, cardiovascular and weight loss benefits to it. But it was something that on its own had a factor of preventing the onset of cognitive decline and Alzheimer's. And that's where a lot of our research started, a lot of our hard science research started looking at animals and then humans as to what exercise really did. And in the book, I talk a lot about that, about how all this takes place, what happens and why. Basically, the clinical studies are very affirmative of it having a positive effect on one's memory and cognitive abilities.
Is there a normal cognitive decline that comes as we enter our middle years?
No, what you were saying about the 40s and 50s when we start losing proper names, that sort of happens anyway to all of us.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean that's a sign of further cognitive decline at all.
So there's a normal cognitive.
It may be. It may be, but we all sort of begin to either block, as Schechter calls it, or forget, and then remember a little later. You can't sort as well. And one of the findings, even while we're exercising, even mildly, our sorting skills go up, and over the long term, they get a bit better with exercise.
So,
and it certainly prevents further decline and actual regrowth of cells in the brain if in an overstressed or depressive situation, or even in Alzheimer's or elderly patients who begin exercising. The fascinating studies are that they show brain growth fairly quickly in certain areas of the brain that are sensitive to the memory.
So exercise causes a growth of cells in the parts of the brain that are sensitive to memory.
Yes, and in our frontal cortex, which is all about being our executive, there seems to be a flowering of the cells that are there. We're not sure whether they're brand new cells in the hippocampus, which is the central station of our memory function in the brain. That, in fact, grows and flowers, and we actually add new cells every day. Anyway, but exercise really speeds the process up.
John,
and that may or may not be wonderful. we're not quite sure if that means that's why people that exercise have increased capacity or stop losing capacity, but it seems like that's a target and a trigger.
I was going to ask you, does the growth of new cells mean that our brain functions more efficiently, or do we not know?
Well, you know, it's argued every which way but up and down, you know, that it seems like it. It certainly parallels an improvement in cognition and memory.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will argue that with every new memory we make a new brain cell to help log it in and direct it, which is, you know, fanciful. But it's a nice, at this point in time, we're still wondering about that, but we certainly know that exercise promotes the flowering and the growth of the existing nerve cells, keeps them stronger, builds up oxidative enzymes that we all worry about, you know, to battle those free radicals that are running around causing havoc inside mm-hmm. the cell, and the oxidative enzymes that you're pushed to take in vitamin C and vitamin E and all the others that we need to, that in fact, by doing exercise and other good things, we build up an army of anti-stress, anti-aging enzymes and proteins inside the cell to keep us resilient, healthy, and happy.
So, and in parallel with that, then, no question, more effective cognition, better memory.
Yes.
Yeah. Dr. John Rady is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard. His new book is called Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. We're at 614-292-8513. Callers right to you. Vivian is on the line. Hi.
Hi. Fred has had guests on that spoke several times on brain plasticity. And I was wondering, Doctor, if you know whether the games, the books that are out there and the games that you should play and things like that on a computer or like crossword puzzles or things like that, if any of them really work when it comes to brain plasticity, memory, having just a healthier mind, and which ones would you recommend, if you recommend any, and where are they available?
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, there's a lot of things that are great for the brain. Learning in general is one of the other factors that retards cognitive decline and onset of Alzheimer's, people that are constantly learning new things. And the brain games and POSIT science, POSIT science, is the one that's perhaps most studied and most scientifically credible out of the University of California, San Francisco, and they've been at it for quite some time and have some real, honest-to-God, science data in terms of improving improving memory, improving cognition, improving intellectual capacity, and hopefully preventing cognitive decline. The other brain games and Sudoku and crosswords and playing chess and learning a new language, all those are great for the brain and improve plasticity, because what you're doing is you're stressing those cells that are involved. And the stress after you're done, the stress which is activity of the brain cells, it causes a reaction, and the reaction is growth. Mm-hmm. And the growth means better, weller, healthier, longer living, turn off the bad genes intracellularly. And learning does that in certain areas of the brain, okay? But exercise does it all over the brain, because all the cells are being challenged or being activated when we're exercising for a variety of reasons. But so that it's all the cells in the brain then get a growth spurt, if you will, or change their pattern with exercising.
Okay, Vivian, give you some hints.
Thank you very much.
Sure, thanks a lot. So, John, in other words, what we're having here is that just as we stress our muscles in running, let's say, and then they repair and grow, the same for the cells in the brain. A little stress is a good thing.
Yes, in my stress chapter, I emphasize that. In fact, one of the ways we think of some of the vegetables that we are so commonly are told are good for us, is one of the ways they are good for us is that they're a little contain their own little neurotoxin or little bits of factors that actually have a negative effect or cause a little toxic effect to occur in our cells, and this creates a response. And the response is to not only deal with that toxic issue, but to build up reserves in the future, the same way with stress and learning and activity in general.
Mm-hmm. So broccoli, for example, has some neurotoxins involved
yes.
in its consumption, but that stresses us just a little bit and helps us to grow.
Right. It's sulforan, actually, in broccoli. It's one of those ones we know of. And we grow our own antioxidants inside the cell with this, and that's why broccoli is so darn good for you, and onions and garlic and cumin and red grapes and drinking a case of wine a night or something like that that people were into for a while because of resveratrol, one of the other popular new chemicals that people are all talking about.
So drinking red wine in moderation is a
good idea? Yes, I was teasing about it. That people said it was estimated you had to drink a case a night to really get the benefits of resveratrol, but actually that's not true. I mean, red grape juice and red wine contain a little bit of this resveratrol, which has a positive effect on our nerve cells and on our cells in our body to keep us young and cancer-resistant and all that.
614-292-8513 with Tom. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to ask Dr. Rady if he's familiar with a study that's being done by the Ohio State University College of Medicine, basically on the beneficial effects of yoga. Yoga has been around for a long time. There's a lot of conventional wisdom and anecdotal evidence of benefits that come from it, but apparently they felt that there was not the scientific evidence there. And what I understood of it, they took 50 women between the ages of 35 and 65, two groups, 25 that were experienced at yoga and 25 that were not, and enrolled them in this course where they would come in and actually do yoga, and they would take measurements. In fact, I think they used a catheter so that they could do a blood draw before, during, and after the test. I heard about this about 2 years ago, and I'm not sure if the test has been completed or is still ongoing. But the basic things that they were looking for was the effect on the immune system, the healing process, and a group of compounds called cytokines, which I think the doctor may be familiar with. I'm not. They could measure those and see what can be the outcome from practicing yoga.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure of whether it was Ohio State or not, but there are a number of people who have looked at yoga, not only for the immune system, but also for anxiety and mood regulation, and it certainly seems like it has a very positive effect, certainly with the immune side of things. And the cytokines is exactly what I'm talking about in terms of the stress, overstress situation, and then the recovery. We think of stress when the word is mentioned as toxic stress, but think about yoga, where you, in the various positions and everything, you're really stressing your body and your muscles and your joints and all. And with that comes the other side of the cytokines. There's a whole raft of those little things buzzing around all the time, and we produce more of some kind when we're stressed, but then there's when that goes away, then we have these recovery cytokines that come in and help us grow and be more healthy and alert our immune system, but also in the brain to help the brain cells be ready to optimally to bind one to another.
Mm-hmm. So some scientific evidence that yoga has a beneficial effect
yes.
on the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There are a number of kinds of yoga, and I think the one that is most commonly practiced is Hatha yoga, and it not only consists of a group of poses, postures, exercises, but periods of meditation. I practice yoga, and I think that meditation is a great stress reducer and calming effect in a busy world.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. It's something that I recommend to people, and Tai Chi, Zen meditation, and certainly just regular meditative relaxation response kind of things that help us sort of clear the cobwebs and settle down a bit. And certainly that's one way of doing it. And you combine that with exercise, aerobic exercise, and I think you're in business.
Dr. John Rady, again, Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His new book is Spark, the Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. We'll find out more after these messages at WOSU 820, NPR News.
Next time on Day to Day, try explaining America's healthcare system to people in France.
Oh, la, 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 la. I mean, to them, that made absolutely no sense.
Why is it such a foreign concept?
There are no uninsured in France.
Does anyone ever go broke over their personal healthcare costs?
No, that's completely unheard of.
How did France get the highest rated healthcare system in the world? Their prescription and the price. Next time on Day to Day.
That story is coming up on Day to Day, when Day to Day begins at noon, just about 30 minutes away, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 80 degrees at 11:30. Thanks for joining us for this encore presentation of Open Line. This is the best of Open Line. We're pre-recorded today, so no phone calls, please. Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine Shodich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News. On your drive home, catch up on the day's events and business news with All Things Considered and Marketplace, now on WOSU 89.7 FM, weekdays from 4 until 7 o'clock. In the forecast for today, sunny skies and a high near 90. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. We're learning that there's plenty of scientific evidence to show that regular aerobic exercise can improve the functioning of our brains to help reduce the negative effects of stress, to relieve anxiety and depression, to decrease our chances of developing memory loss, and to mitigate the effects of aging on the functions of our brains. We're learning more with Dr. John Rahe. He's Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard. Again, his new book, Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. As always, when we have a physician on the air, no personal questions, but the general questions we welcome at 614-292-8513. John, let's get right down to the basics here. Tell me, what's the minimum exercise program, aerobic exercise program, that will bring all the benefits in terms of our brains that we've been talking about?
Well, you know, most studies look at people doing exercise 4 days a week for 30 to 40 minutes and getting your heart rate up to what's around 70 to 75% of the max, or heart rate maximum, which is the way you determine your own heart rate maximum, is you take the number 220 and subtract your age, and then you take a percentage of that. So 70% of that would be what your target heart rate is to be at the 70% range. And that's usually right before you're getting breathless, or where you can't really talk to somebody you're having a brisk walk with or talking to or on a treadmill with or on a run with or playing tennis with. Mm-hmm. So that's where the studies are, about three or four times a week, sometimes five. But I think the Health and Human Services recommendation is to do something every day, and I'd go with that, but at least 5 days a week for 40 minutes or so of getting your heart rate up, maybe not that high, but high enough to make a difference. And certainly that's great for your body. The more you do, the better, until you really go over the top and start trying to run marathons and triathlons and all that.
So that's what's going to be effective, and it's important you stress that it be aerobic, because non-aerobic exercise does not necessarily confer the same benefits.
It doesn't. It all the studies so far, it certainly has some effect and some beneficial effect, but not at the same level, just like yoga and Tai Chi and all that. All the other exercising, meditations kinds of things have a nice effect on clinical measures of anxiety and depression and stress, but aerobic exercise seems to always take first chair when you're looking for something to do to mm-hmm. really impact the way the brain is functioning and helping to get it at the optimal functioning rate.
Do we know why aerobic exercise has this effect and non-aerobic exercise does not?
Well, I think it has something to do with constantly stressing the blood supply, mm-hmm. Constantly changing and getting all your cells trying to figure out what's going on there when you're in the aerobic situation as opposed to the others,
mm-hmm.
And where it's intermittent and your heart rate isn't kept up. Now, a lot of people who do lift weights really lift in the aerobic range, and then temporarily get into the anaerobic or the when they're really struggling, and then they get back down to it. And so strength training is absolutely a component of being healthy, especially as we age, as you mentioned, for osteoporosis reasons and for just general health reasons. So you can do your aerobic exercise, but it's certainly shown that aerobic exercise should be a component, a key central component of a person's health program.
Mm-hmm. At 614-292-8513, our next caller is Dave. Hello, Dave.
Yes, good morning. I have a weekly program four times a week of running on the treadmill about a half an hour, and then also immediately thereafter do weightlifting for about 45 minutes. Is there any positive, negative aspects that should watch with that program, or should you split it up, running one day, weightlifting the next?
No, I think you're doing if you can do that and you're in the habit of doing it and that's most convenient and most likely to persist, then I would say go for it, man.
Okay.
Doing that is excellent. It's nice to split it up just because it, as I just was saying, it's an aerobic challenge anyway when you're weightlifting most of the time, but then at times your heart rate doesn't stay as up or it gets way over, which also has some incredible benefits, but doing something every day is some activity in our very sedentary world that we're all prisoners of, and happily so, I must say, but we're still not moving like our genes that we inherited from the hunter-gatherer period some 15,000 years ago when we're supposed to be moving about 8 miles a day.
Do you recommend keeping it the same program, doing the running and the weightlifting the same day?
Well, if you're more likely to sustain it, see, because, to continue doing it rather than splitting it up. So
exactly.
I wouldn't alter if that's the most convenient. See, the biggest problem is that people starting an exercise program, 50% of them, even though they notice the benefits, they feel much better and all, 50% of them will stop.
John, why do you think that happens? Why do people stop? I've seen that happen.
We need to ritualize it in our lives and recognize, and that's a big reason why I wrote the book, that it really provides, I think, the most important aspect of why we should exercise every day. That is to keep our brains healthy and optimally functioning and our moods the best, and it improves motivation and socialization and certainly our cognitive functioning. And a big part of the book is focused on schools and how schools are, this one school system in Naperville, Illinois, has really sort of revolutionized the way they have integrated exercise into every pupil's lives, where 45 minutes a day they're really exercising and they're measured and graded on their heart rate monitors that they wear, so that they have to... the goal is to keep them in their zone for a good part of the time they're participating in the gym class. So it's designed and evolved over a 15-year period, and chapter one is a sort of an expression of what they've done and what they're doing now. Schools that are reinstituting exercise programs quickly find that there's a decrease in violence and aggressive incidences, for instance, and
They measure an actual decrease.
Yes. Oh, one inner-city school in Kansas City started now 2.5 years ago exercising every day for 45 minutes when they had 45 minutes a week prior to that, and it was all focused mainly on cardiovascular exercise, mm-hmm. and they found a 63% drop in what's called a disciplinary referrals
mm-hmm.
In the first year, and other schools have noted similar kinds of findings throughout the country. So that seems to happen quickly. And then other schools have seen a rise in their board scores or their No Child Left Behind scores that all the school children have to take.
And it seemed to be hard to correlate, though. In other words, let's say you instituted an exercise program and then you had a rise in your proficiency test scores. Wouldn't it be hard to correlate that one was the effect of the other?
Oh, yes. No, it's absolutely very, very difficult. I think everybody points to the California study where they looked at the fitness gram. It's a six measures of fitness, the main one being cardiovascular, but strength and upper body strength and flexibility and all that. There are six components of it, and they've grafted, and this they looked at a million children in 2001, 2003, and 2005. And every year, the fitter the pupil was, that is, the more successful in each of those fitness gram incidences were, the better their scores were in reading and in math. Hmm. And that goes... in a big way to sort of covering over all the errors you might get in correlating.
In
a million is a big number.
A million is a big number, yeah. Dave, thanks for your call, 614-292-8513. John, you recommend starting, let's say somebody's, you know, pretty much a couch potato. You recommend starting with getting a pedometer.
Yep.
And and measuring maybe 10,000 steps a day.
Yep, there's a program that the name escapes me because I'm over 50 right now. I had my senior moment on the name of that program, but there's a program that's been started for some time urging people to do that in the workplace and each day moving 10,000 steps. That's one sure way to make sure you're getting enough movement and exercise in your life. And that's a start.
It's a start. But also, you're saying the steps, if they were strolling rather than aerobic, wouldn't be of as much benefit. So do you recommend getting yourself a heart rate monitor as well?
Well, I think people are doing that. I think, you know, if you're having a brisk walk, and certainly if you're a couch potato, you just want to start walking the more and more distance, you know, more and more time until you begin to feel your oats and feel that you can do it and you're not going to hurt yourself, then you want to go to a brisk walk. And usually a brisk walk is getting near the aerobic range or where a lot of the benefits really begin to accrue. But walking in general is a fine way to manage the your certainly your body and as well as your brain.
John, in Spark, you write something very interesting. You say some of us may be genetically programmed to dislike exercise or to not get a big mood boost out of it. Tell me about that.
Yes, there's probably 10% or maybe less than that of people who don't feel the benefit of the boost, or they don't feel the cognitive improvement in it. And it's hard to know. I mean, people in the Europe have been looking at this for some time and trying to figure out what are the genes and all that. It's probably a combination of many of them. But there are people that really don't feel the mood change and the benefit. Most people do, about 95% of people, when they're finished with exercising, will report that they feel better, that mm-hmm. their mood is improved, their feeling of vigor is increased. And part of that is being done with the exercise. Part of it is feeling like they could do it. And I think that's one of the big factors in why it may be as good or better as an antidepressant, is that you're the person who's doing it. You're the agent of change in your life. And I think that goes a long way to making us feel more, not only in control of our lives, but more enabled and more effective in what we do.
You mentioned depression again. You do write that the American Psychiatric Association did not include exercise in a list of approved remedies for depression.
Right.
How come?
Well, they did. They didn't because it was not there yet. I mean, and I think in Big Pharma has, you know, all the drug companies and all have really invaded our thinking, just as you were proposing somebody coming in with the depression to the doctor's office, or which anxiety agent, which antidepressant are they going to choose, as opposed to how they're going to help them maybe really change their life in such a way that they could benefit, like adding in exercise to their life. Mm-hmm. We don't think immediately of exercise as a tool, as an agent. But it really is. And in fact, this year, for the first time ever, there was what's called a continuing medical education course in one of our big psychiatric journals about the effects of exercise on anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. So it's invading slowly, and more evidence. And part of the reason, again, why I write the book for my colleagues was to get them involved in thinking about what their patients are going through, and also to help our patients sort of know that they can be really effective in changing their mood and their anxiety level, their stress level, their attention level, which is part of what, I mean, I've written a bunch of books on attention deficit disorder, and certainly exercise can improve the attention somewhat almost immediately after exercising, lasting for a couple hours. But over the long haul, the more fit you are, the better attending you are. And certainly as we begin to age, there's a lot of evidence around that.
With attention deficit disorder, exercise can be helpful, but it doesn't necessarily remove the need for pharmaceuticals?
Sometimes. It can. I have a case in my chapter on ADD, ADHD, that talks of one chap who really hated the medicine and found exercises about an hour a day, and it was pretty stressing and straining, but over time he found that he didn't need his medicine anymore, and that can happen. But it usually works in tandem. It's certainly not something that you want to say one thing or another, because the medication can be so helpful and so vital in many cases.
Mm-hmm. Dr. John Rady is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard. His new book is Spark, the Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. We're at 614-292-8513. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Okay. Hi. It's Kathy?
Hi. Yeah.
Hi. I'm actually a ballet teacher, and so my students get a lot of exercise. But what I've noticed is their ability to retain, to memorize, or keep an exercise from day to day is quite weak. And I wonder what the effect computers have had on the younger generation and on culture in general, because we push that enter button, we don't have to retain.
Oh, you're so right.
Well, and I've stressed out my kids a lot because they can't retain.
Right, because our cyber world has made it so we don't train up the attention system or those retaining parts of things. I mean, we can Google it right away, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, even for us adults, or
right.
We can copy it and put it into another document if you're, you know, you don't even go over the spelling anymore. I find myself that way. And it's just addictive, you know, because it's so quick and sure. And so in our children, you're right. That's one of the reasons why I think attention has sort of begun to drop overall in all of us. But our cyber slaves, you know, that we can push buttons and mm-hmm. have everything magically appear and come to us, that certainly makes it tougher for retaining and working at it. Our frustration tolerance is less, mm-hmm. certainly with the games and the, clicker for the TV. You just don't get bored, or you don't sustain the interest in long enough, or think about things you don't contemplate or as much, and because it's a quick hit and just go to something new. I've talked a lot about that in many different vehicles, but it's just something that I think we're dealing with. And one of the things I think that exercise regimens do, or ballet. Ballet is great. It's one of the things I certainly recommend for ADD children. Ballet and also Tai Chi and Taekwondo, karate, all those are attention demanding mm-hmm. while you're in a pretty good aerobic state, you know, because you to make the movements and then make it with others and to make them correctly really demand a lot of focus and concentration, which I think is one way to combat the Game Boys and the movies and all that immediate access entertainment our world is now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Kathy?
Yeah, thanks. I don't know if we should restrict the number of hours that we allow our kids to go onto the computer. I know that my son is quite addicted to it, but he's very bright.
Maybe it's very addicting kind of thing. You know, the video games are really compelling and give us the same kind of buzz in our brains that that our drugs of addiction do. You know, it pumps up the dopamine, this what I call a dopamine squirt when you're playing in the video games, because it's a challenge and it's creative and it's fun and it grabs you. And as we know, people can get really addicted to video games, and a lot of kids have become so.
John, let me ask you, you say it's challenging and creative and fun, so isn't that learning then? It isn't a video
game?
Yes,
it certainly is, but it's learning in a restricted way, and it's certainly in a directed and then a repetitive kind of thing, and it doesn't as much prepare you for the rest of life. You know, mm-hmm. it's like the social involvement is lessened, and your hand-eye coordination is usually much improved. But other than that, your response time with the hand-eye is improved. But you end up sitting there and truncating your life.
It's pretty narrow. Yeah.
And you become very addicted. And I have a chapter on addiction in the book too, where exercise really does some of the same things to help reduce the cravings, and we certainly know it's useful for smokers who want to stop.
So, John, would you restrict the amount of time that your children could go on a computer?
I think I would. You know, it's hard to do, but I certainly would try to push more alternatives, mm-hmm. and then end up restricting with TV and as well as with time spent on computer games, and it's hard because everybody does it,
sure.
And they go away to school, and
everybody does it in school.
Oh yeah. And they have clubs and all that. You know, when it's because of its draw, and it's a big problem.
Thanks, Kathy. Thanks for your call.
A
few more minutes here with Dr. John Rahe, Spark, the revolutionary new science of exercise in the brain, 614-292-8513. John, you say women are particularly likely to get benefits out of aerobic exercise.
Right. I think I have a chapter on women, and that I was just, when I began to write the chapter, it grew and grew and grew, and we had to cut it in half, actually, to get it into the book. But because there's so much data and so much information and so much new stuff for me. For instance, I sort of knew that exercise was useful for people who had PMS, for women who had PMS, and I knew that it was useful for depressed patients, and women are much more depressive than men in general, or have depression problems more and anxiety, and that exercise helps there. But I didn't realize how important it was for pregnancy. Now, most people think both ways. I mean, most people think that you should moderate your exercise or stop it when you're pregnant. Well, in fact, in 2001, the American College of OBGYN came out and said every woman who's exercising and gets pregnant should continue to exercise as much as they've been doing in the past, but then to start moderate as the pregnancy moves forward. And that if you are sedentary, that you should begin an exercise program at least three times a week, mm-hmm. for an hour walk a day. If you're pregnant and you're sedentary, that exercise is important. Not only does it help with all the health issues and the problems with diabetes and hypertension, and it helps sustain the pregnancy to full term, but it has an interesting impact on the babies, the outcome, if you will. One particular guy, Dr. Clapp from Case Western Reserve in your state, has done a lot of looking at this, at its effect in a very scientific way on the mother and the fetus or the baby, and then following a number of studies throughout the 90s on children born of exercising moms, and finding that they're as healthy, and it may be quicker at age one, and at age five had a higher IQ score than the babies, same control babies, of moms that weren't exercising during pregnancy. Now, that's maybe a genetic issue or an environmental issue, one can't say, but because it was a small study, but still it was really quite impressive. So, And then certainly for postpartum issues, which are very important for women, to almost 12% of women develop a postpartum depression, but exercise is one way of staving it off, of getting right up there, back exercising or start exercising after the pregnancy is completed. And then, of course, in perimenopausal time, we see a lot of evidence that exercise is useful there to help with mood and stress and cognitive issues, to keep the cognitive decline from escalating and coming forward.
Sure.
The more exercise you do, the better.
And again, in pregnancy, moderating your exercise as your pregnancy moves along,
yes,
obviously.
Yes, yes.
John, tell me about your exercise program. What did you do today?
What I did today, I did 40 minutes today on the elliptical stair climber at about 6:30 to a little after 7. And then I came to my office and started to work.
Okay.
So I do that every morning because of it's a way I can ritualize it. I beat the traffic into my office and go to the gym right by my office, and it's one sure way for me to start the day, and I love it and recommend it. That it's a good day, it's a good way to start the day. I didn't do any weights today, but I do them a couple times a week too, just to keep my muscles and bones in shape.
Now, will you do more exercise today, or is that it?
That's it for today because I'm traveling, but and that's mostly what I do. I used to play squash 3 times a week, but my shoulders, as I have aged, have given way, so can't do that anymore, which is a big loss.
So,
and that's one of the big things too, is being, the exercise isn't just going to the gym or going for a walk, but the more you can engage with other people for the social benefits as well as the glue to be exercising is the best way to start and continue.
Also, in finding some exercise that you think is fun to do. I mean, if we do exercise that we find boring, we're likely to let it go.
Right, exactly. So it's fun with another person, or in a game, or in a league, or those really are ways of keeping our focus on it and not seeming like you're exercising. When I played squash, I didn't even notice that I was really running it at a very high rate and having my heart rate up for 45 minutes.
And again, walking out of doors might be it for some people too, because they're seeing interesting people in places, and walking
right
alone might be good for other people. Walking together with others might be good for others.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Well, Dr. John Rady has been with us, a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His new book is entitled Spark. It's subtitled The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. John, very informative. I'm going to increase my exercise according to your recommendations, and I thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's really a delight being in Columbus.
Thank you, Charlie Pickett at the controls, Nick Long on the phones. This is listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 is NPR News.